This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
This is Brightside Home Theater.
Hey, home theater nerds, welcome to the Brightside Home Theater Podcast, the podcast that's all about the experiences we have in our theaters, the sights, the sounds, and this week, the experiences I get to talk to Brent Butterworth. Yep, that's the title of the show. I know you know that. I'm super excited. And how great is he just sitting here waiting in the green room, waiting for me? We've got to get through this. I'm going to try to be really quick with this week, really quick, so we can get right to the interview, the conversation, the chat, whatever you want to call it. And we had a lot of fun, but he's sitting there hanging out, waiting for me. So let's get to this as quick as we can. My name's DJ. I am the host of the show this week. You can reach me on Twitter at BrightsideHT, or you can email me at BrightsideHomeTheater@gmail.com, or you can check out this podcast and all the other podcasts at the website, BrightsideHomeTheater.com. And if you're not watching this on YouTube, you can go to YouTube and click subscribe. That would be great. The video this week isn't so great. Brent had a little issue with his, it just wasn't uploading correctly. We had a little delay. You'll hear that in the conversation. And you also, it's a little pixelated, had a little trouble downloading it with Squadcast, which we'll get to in a second. It's the audio fine. You can hear the conversation fine. I'm super excited for that. Can't wait for you guys to hear that. But on Patreon, thank you to my 14 patrons, still standing strong at 14, loving it. Thank you very much. Appreciate all the support. If you'd like to support the podcast and join the 14 and become 15, maybe 16, 17, 18, all the way up, you can go to patreon.com/Brightside Home Theater. Click. Hit subs, and you can donate as little as a dollar, as much as you'd like, but it goes to help produce the podcast with, you know, Squadcast paying for that and all the stuff that I do. It's not necessary. I do this I love doing this. I'll pay for it. I was doing it before I got any support, monetarily that is, and I will continue to do it if they all go away. I love doing this. I love talking to people like Brent. I love talking about home theater. If you'd like to support me monetarily, you can do that, or go to the website, click on the red button that says donate. That would be great too. Another way to support the podcast, follow me on Twitter. We have 3 new followers this week: George's Electronics Marketplace, Rodrigo Bilro, and squadcast.fm. That's the place that I go to host people, and they are really cool. This isn't a commercial. I've been using them for years with my other podcast because John lives in Texas. I live here, and it just makes it so much easier. The process John and I used to go through, and I know this sounds like a commercial, but it's really not. I don't do commercials. I talk about things I like, and they make my job so much easier because they actually record it for me. If you have good internet and stuff, everything's fine. And it works great, and it solves a lot of problems. And even if you don't have good internet, like in the case with Brent and I this week, if we didn't have that, I would have had to have like so many more headaches, as people know in podcasting, when you try to host people and get good audio quality, it's really tough. And they've been the best that I've found, and I'm still shopping, always looking for an upgrade. As you know, that's home theater, but yeah, they're pretty cool. So just thought I'd give them a shout out. I've been using them for probably almost 2 years now. John and I definitely. And every time I host here. All right, let's move along quickly because we have listener comments to get to. And this week, listener comments from WV Brew at Brightside HT. My parents took us 4 kids and my grandmother, who was so sweet and funny, kind of like Aunt Betsy, to see on vacation. After watching Rambo 2, she said, Well, it wasn't much of a movie, but boy, does he have a great body. And he sent a picture along, the one where he's being, where Stallone's being pulled out of the mud pit and or the sewerage, actually, with the leeches all over him. And he's all stretched out and his abs and everything. And yeah, he's all ripped up. Yeah, couldn't agree more with your grandmother there, W.V. Brew. He does have quite the body. Also, moving along, Mark V, this is where I'm trying to be quick this week, but you never know because I'm going to go off, not on a tangent, but I love to reply to these questions, so I had to put them in. Mark V, at Brightside HT, yo, DJ, question, I'm going to buy the Fast and Furious 20th Anniversary Edition pretty soon. I wonder if anyone in the community has compared the DTS X track on the 4K to the DTS Neural X on the regular Blu-ray. Is it a huge difference, or does Neural X do a good job? And then the reply from Steve George after I gave my reply. Steve says, agreed 100%. DTS track on the 4K is great. And I replied to Mark saying, in my experience, the actual track is always better than the upmix that Neural X does. Neural X or the Dolby Surround upmix, they're fantastic when you don't have the actual Atmos or DTS:X available. They do a really good job of placing the sounds where they're supposed to be according to what is on the track. For instance, last week, Rambo First Blood Part 2, it put everything where it's supposed to be. And that's where it was on that track. It put it all to the front of the room. But if you have a nicely mixed track and it's supposed to sound like it's going to go overhead, it'll upmix that and utilize your overheads to create a better sense of that sound. But the DTS:X and the Atmos tracks where they actually move the sound that way is far better. It's usually much, much better. Actually, not usually. I've yet to experience an upmix that was better than the actual Atmos mix. And we get into that a little bit. Brent and I talk about that a little bit. But I also get a question this week from my buddy Theo. And he asks, hi, DJ, what sounds better to you, DTS:X or a Dolby Atmos mix? And here's the thing, and I think I'm pretty sure this is what Brent and I actually touch on a little bit, is that there is no better. And that's what I replied to him. Between the two of them, one is not better than the other. They both play the full spectrum of sound that we can hear, right? They both have the same ability of moving the sound, you know, object-based around the room. So really, what is better? I've heard 5.1 mixes that'll rival DTS:X or Dolby Atmos. I've heard Atmos mixes that will rival DTS:X. I've heard DTS:X mixes that are better than Atmos mixes. They're actually two different ways of mixing the sound, but to say which one is better than the other, there, in my opinion, and I'm not even sure if it's an opinion, one isn't better than the other. It's like saying, what I said to Theo was, it's like saying, what's the best hockey stick? Wayne Gretzky used an Easton hockey stick his entire career, but Ray Bourque used a Sherwood. Who got more points? Who did what better? They're both good hockey sticks. It's how you utilize it. DTS:X or Dolby Atmos is just a tool to bring the sound to our theaters. How you utilize that, how the artist, the sound designer, the engineer, sound engineer, how they utilize it is up to them on the better quality tracks that we hear. Now, here's the caveat. DTS:X probably, and this is my opinion, but DTS:X pretty much has the better tracks. I said this a while ago in a podcast that when you see a DTS mix or a movie comes out in DTS:X, you can almost guarantee that that is going to be an awesome track, because I feel like DTS:X or DTS, that is the little brother in this case, and they're always trying to catch Dolby or they're trying to one-up Dolby. there are far more Dolby Atmos mixes out there, and there are mixes that aren't very good in Dolby Atmos, but there are fantastic mixes in Dolby Atmos, right? Try to name me a DTS:X mix that isn't very good, that fell flat. There aren't any. And for instance, my next week's podcast, where I'm doing Independence Day, that does not fall flat at all. And it's in DTS:X. It's almost like a stamp of approval now when you see it. Oh, this movie's coming out in DTS:X. I can't wait to hear it. It's almost guaranteed it's going to be awesome. But that doesn't mean DTS:X is the better mix. It just means that when the artist sits down to mix the sound for this, he knows he's using DTS:X. You just know you're going to get a great mix, because they're putting the Apollo 13 is another one jumps to mind. They're just great mixes. But like I said, it's like going back to the Easton and the Sherwood hockey stick. Just because he scored more goals with the Easton, it doesn't mean that stick is better than the Sherwood. And the same, you know, that's the best analogy I could come up with for that. So that's my feeling on it. I really don't think that there's any difference between the two codecs. But yes, we do get better mixes with the DTS:X just because they're trying really hard to catch up to Dolby Atmos. Emails this week. This one comes from G. Cornell regarding behind the screen. So he says, I've come to the conclusion that those who say they want their center speaker behind the screen to anchor the voices to the actors as opposed to above or below the screen have never heard a correctly done setup to know what is possible. Watch The Ice Road on Netflix, and in an early scene, 11 men below ground in a mine sound off as they're doing a count. With my center speaker below the screen and two speakers on each side of the screen, all 11 voices came from the positions on the screen that matched where each man was located. Your experience as well? And yes, in my experience, and I have two that I'd like to talk about here. So, in my experience, yeah, you can put the speakers to either side of the screen, depending on your size of your screen. If your screen is really, really big, it gets a little tougher as you move it, as it gets taller and taller. It gets harder to notice that. But here's the experience I wanted to relay to you guys. This is a great question, because people think that you have to have it behind the screen, and you don't, especially for a typical screen. I think if it's over 150 inches, it gets a little wonky where the sound, you actually do start to notice it, because it the center becomes further away. But here's the thing. When I built my theater, my first screen was an daylight acoustically transparent screen. And I wanted all my speakers behind the screen, because that's what happens in a real movie theater. And I loved it. I loved the sound. I loved the panning. I loved everything about it. But as resolution went up and 4K came out and HDR, and my projection guy was like, you got to get rid of this because it wasn't meant for that. He goes, you got to go to a solid screen, move your speakers to the side, blah, blah, blah. You'll have better resolution. You don't want those little holes, because I had a perforated screen, not a weave. And he's like, it's going to cause problems as you get into 4K. So I upgraded to my Stewart screen. Anyways, when I moved everything, I could all of a sudden hear a difference, because it was in my head. I was thinking, like, that speaker is down there, but I'm only at 110 inches. I actually went up. I was at 104 with my first screen. I went to 110, and I could tell the difference, but it was only for like the first day, because I was focusing my eyes on that speaker. I'm like, oh no, this isn't as good. This isn't as good. There's a major like psychological trick going on when you're watching a movie and you get enveloped into these movies. You think the sound is coming right from their mouth, when obviously it's not an opinion. It's coming from the speaker, right? So the speaker's down below, and it's just your head, your eyes are so powerful. in the thought, you like everything we base everything on our site pretty much, and you're putting it there. Now, this great sound design, they'll help mix that to pull it to the side so you'll hear it, and they'll put it, like, if the speaker is, not the speaker, but the character is slightly to the right, they'll pull it using the right channel, but it's still now a mix, but your head, your brain is going to mix that all together and put it right out of his lips right there on the screen, which is fantastic. If you close your eyes and try to listen and don't look at the screen, you'll probably be able to pick it out, like, okay, it is being mixed here, or it's down low. In a bad mix, you'll notice it's right down low below the speaker, where the speaker is. There's a lot going on. So you don't need to have the perforated screen or, you know, acoustically transparent screen, because your eyes and your brain will mix it all for you. But it is a lot of fun to have that all set up behind you. And the bigger you get, it will be harder. Your ears will be able to, like I said, I think it's 150-inch. Ask the AV Rent guys. They'd know. And same with HD guys. They would know. I think it's 150 inches. If you're over that, it is a little bit harder to trick your brain. That is the best way to put it. But it is a lot of fun, and I've had issues where I wanted to have, I may go back to acoustically transparent, because the screens are getting better when I upgrade my theater someday. So great question. You guys let me know what you think. Because I really enjoy having them to the either side in the really nice screen, but I could go either way, but it is a lot of fun. All right, let's move this right along, because we've got, I can't wait to get to the interview. All right, we're up to new releases. First up, this week we have Howard the Duck coming out this week. Also, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Also, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in 4K. This one I'll be picking up. Howard the Duck, I'm on the fence, not really sure. Probably not picking up Scott Pilgrim, just not my cup of tea. But Willy Wonka, I'm definitely for those colors. I'm grabbing that one. And next week, we're jumbling these up together. This one's coming out Tuesday, this podcast will be out on Friday. So Tuesday, I'm looking forward to Space Jam. So far this week, we have Howard the Duck came out pretty much as I'm recording this. Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory all came out this week. Next week, we have Space Jam. Now, the reason I'm doubling it up is because I thought it was weird to, like, 3 days later to be talking about what came out. So I'm going to give you what's coming next week. And I'm really excited for Space Jam. I don't know why. I'm Michael Jordan, best basketball player ever. And I'm from Boston, and most people here would say Larry Bird, but I got to say Michael Jordan. I had so much fun watching him. Every championship, I had a blast. And Bugs Bunny. You can't get better than that, right? I guess. All right. Let's move this along. Movies and Scenes. Mark V again. And this was a couple weeks ago. I actually found this as I was looking through. I apologize for not mentioning it. And if I did mention it, I apologize for bringing it up again, especially this week where I'm in RE. All right. Mark V says, DJ needs to start talking about Big Trouble in Little China. Then maybe they'll release a 4K of that. See if they can improve over the Blu-ray. And yeah, Big Trouble, Little China. I love that movie. I would love to see that in 4K. It has so much going for it. It would be a blast. So great one there. And actually makes me want to go and check out the Blu-ray that I'll just pop in and go see that. But all right, that's it for this week. And we got to bring Brent. He's been so patient sitting there waiting while we do this. But Brent Butterworth, I mean, if you don't know who he is, he's Home Theater Magazine is where I heard him first. And I say that, and I say it in the interview. I didn't hear him on Home Theater Magazine. I read him on Home Theater Magazine, but he moved on, obviously, Sound and Vision, Home Theater Review, Video Magazine, The Wire Cutter, Popular Science, Bicycling Magazine. We talk about that. We get into bicycles. We get into movies. We go back and forth. I had so much fun, and I'll be back at the end of it to talk to you about that, too, but I had so much fun. I can't wait for you to get right now. He is working for Wirecutter.com. He is working for SoundstageSolo.com. He is working for JazzTimes.com. He's so busy, and he talks about that, all the stuff. It's a blast. let's get you into that interview. And then I'll be back at the end of that because I'm so excited for you guys to hear this. Hey, Brent, how you doing?
Hey, hi, DJ. It's great to be on. Thanks for inviting me.
Hi, I am honored. I have been listening. I say listening, but I haven't been listening to you. I have been reading you since the 90s when I got into home theater. Yeah, back. My earliest memory of you was with Home Theater Magazine. And in looking back and reading about you now, and it's like you got into the tech aspect of it, I guess you say on your website that at 1988.
Just to date me appropriately, the first person I ever interviewed in the audio, you know, our home theater field was Ken Cantor, who at that time had just founded NHT. And I was at the press event where they announced the Home THX program. I was at the launch of Pioneer's second generation, you know, Dolby ProLogic receivers. My first roundup of home theater speakers. The only company that had a horizontal center was Definitive Technology. So, I go back a little. And, you know, I used to work at Video Magazine. That's where I kind of started. And the first issue I worked on had the second ever LCD projector. And it was the Sharp one that was like $5,000 and it was 640 by 480. So, yeah, I go back a little ways.
Yeah, and that's the thing is I started my first home theater in 1988 and I was living at my parents' house and I just started building one in my bedroom. And then in the 90s, I started reading, I saw Home Theater Magazine. I'm like, oh, fantastic. And I'd read your reviews on stuff. And it was just what I really liked with your reviews. And I found a couple that are more recent now. 2013, 2012. But what I always found is that you did a great job of bringing it to somebody like myself that I didn't have the expertise, but I had the love of the movie. And the movies you chose were like, so for instance, in 2013, you did a Sonos soundbar article and you likened it. You used as an example, I should say, Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it's when you do stuff like that, it brought it to me. Like, I love that movie. I want to hear my soundbar on this. And that's so like all of your reviews back then, you know what I mean? Like you read some reviews and people bring out these hoity toity movies to say like, oh, the dialogue in this scene here is fantastic. But you did do that. But you also did, you brought it to people like myself that I just want to hear big explosions. And you really seem to relate that to people like myself that I love home theater and I want to hear things go boom. And it seemed like you did too.
I think that for me, it's like, I liken testing audio gear too. And I have tested video gear, but I'm really not very good at it. I was good at it 30 years ago, but I'm not now. It's changed a lot. And there are a lot of people better than me. So I stick to audio. But with audio, my attitude is that it's like cars, right? Like any car will get you to the grocery store. But I want to put the car on the racetrack and see what it can do. And so with, you know, speakers and amps and things like that, I want to just push them to and past their limits. And movies like that, I mean, that particular movie, you know, starts out with the ship flying over and it has that big low rumbling sound. And that particular sound really kind of made a lot of subwoofers distort and a lot of, sort of quote unquote full range, you know, tower speakers and things. A lot of them would distort or they just wouldn't play it. So that's a scene that kind of tends to break gear, so to speak. Not break it per se, but show you the limits of the gear. And so I'm in my laziness, and also my just constant laziness and constant time crunch. usually, rather than go to some movie, I don't know, some some kind of more artsy movie, which I, maybe what I actually want to see when I'm not testing gear. But instead of going to that, I go straight to the stuff that pushes the gear to the limit, and I crank it really loud, and I see what the stuff can do, because then, you know, that's the part you really need to. That's sort of make or break, right? If you have a big giant subwoofer, let's for example, if you have a big like an 18 inch subwoofer, and you play, you know, the opening of that Tom Cruise movie, Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes.
Okay, you know, it starts with a 16 hertz tone, right? Like, you know, really, really deep.
Okay.
And a lot of people can't
I love this
hear
stuff.
It because because your subwoofer is smarter. If you have a smaller subwoofer, then your subwoofer designer was probably smart enough to filter that stuff out, right? But if you have an 18 inch subwoofer and it chokes on that, then you kind of know right there, this is not a very good 18 inch subwoofer. As opposed to you listening for, you know, hours and hours with some lightweight material. And then of course, yeah, I do that, but then I get into putting on a Steely Dan album and listen for the tunefulness of the bass lines and things like that, and listen for the character of the bass. But you want to, give me a car and give me a sports car, and I would so much rather just take it to the track and floor it. And see what happens. It's just because, you know, if the gear flunks the basic test, you can move on. And, you know, I write for Wirecutter.
Yeah.
And Wirecutter wants to test, you know, the goal is to test kind of everything that's, at least it's worth testing, which if you're doing sound bars is how many sound bars are worth testing? 50, 100. So, and you have a time crunch. So right now I'm doing, I don't know how many new sound bars for Wirecutter, at least 15. And, you know, it'd be nice if I could spend a week with each one, but it's probably more time efficient to spend about 3 hours with each one. And you know, count, which with sound bars these days means an hour of setup because you gotta update them with whatever the latest software is. You gotta get to connect to your Wi-Fi. You gotta deal with whatever problems that you have. But anyway, yeah, I do about a couple hours worth of really, you know, is balls to the wall acceptable to say on a podcast? Whatever.
I
use that kind of material, and then I cut to my real sort of finesse material. And I learn. You know, there are those who say you need to have a piece of gear for umpteen zillion, you know, and have this long-term
hours
exposure. But yeah, but I would say that, you know, if you get into consulting, which I've done as well, you get into actual product development. The product development engineers do not sit there for hours and hours listening to a speaker. You know, they do the same thing. They push it to the limits and see what it can do and run a couple cuts on it, and they can make their judgment pretty quickly. And, you know, long term, I'm rambling, so this is one of my problems.
That's okay.
Long term testing is great, and long term testing is where you start to find a lot of operational problems. You know, this doesn't work with this, or, oh, when you plug this into this, it chokes, right? And that's where you start to run into your HDMI problems and things like that. But for just testing the nuts and bolts of audio, you know, transducers and amplifiers, basically, you know, taking it to the limit right away, I think, is the best way. And it's also the most fun way. So,
oh yeah,
by far.
Well, and that's why I said, like, it's like it relates to people like myself that it's like, and it's funny you mentioned the subwoofer, because you had an article in 2012 that I just found like a week or so ago, because I happened to be looking up the Sunfire Atmos subwoofer. And when I Googled it, because I was looking at a, it's a new YouTube video of this $800,000 home theater. It's like basically they took this company that installs home theaters. They took a house and they put all of their ideas into it. And it's about $800,000 worth of equipment and ideas or whatever. It's a, basically a demo home. And in one of their bathrooms, they said they had a Sunfire Atmos subwoofer. And I hadn't heard of that particular subwoofer yet. And I was like, wait a minute. Did they name, because there's no such thing as Atmos sound subs. But it was actually named that before Atmos came out from Dolby.
Yeah, I think so.
You know what I mean? So, yes. So I was a little confused. So I Googled it. I'm like, is there an Atmos subwoofer? What pops up? And in you and I talking in the last month, I'm like, hey, this it's Brent. He wrote the article. I'm like, okay. So I read the article, and you use the opening to T2 as one, and that's one of my favorite movies. And you had mentioned that the rumble at the beginning of T2 when they have, you know, the skull crushing and stuff in that opening scene.
Yeah. I was just trying to think, like, wait, what was in that movie? That was it, that skull crush scene is
Yeah,
and there's a rumble in there. Overall dynamics, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you, that's what you had. Yeah. And you had mentioned that. And I'm like, and it nailed it for me even a couple of weeks ago because I knew I was going to go back to my old magazines or something just to look up a couple articles. And I'm like, bam, here's one. Accidentally ran across it. But I'm like, here's one where it's, I don't know why, but that just brought it right to me. And that's what always, I always knew your name. Whenever I'd look into the magazines, I'd look for your reviews on movies, on your reviews on equipment, and it was just fun to read. Even if I couldn't afford the equipment and ever could, it was fun to read and recognize because you always put it to movies that I liked. And that's what made it fun because I'm like, all right, now I'm going to try to get to whatever piece of equipment you were talking about. Hey, I'll try to get as close to that piece as I can afford. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's really good to hear. I'm glad that... Because, you know, if you're writing, you get a lot more critical feedback than positive feedback.
Oh.
So I'm really glad to hear that. You know, I think that there's a certain bias in the audio world against fun. And it's supposed to be this, you know, like you're a refined man of culture and you appreciate the subtleties of blah, blah, whatever. But I've just always, that's one of the things that first drew me to home theater, you know, way back when home theater was just starting out, was that it was just so much fun. You know, it was so much of a kick to put on, you know, the THX Wow disc, the laser disc. I don't know if you ever, you probably saw that at some point. The THX Wow disc and crank the system up and it was just, you know, when you had a good system, you know, like a lot of some of the first THX systems, which played loud and were pretty well engineered, you know, it was just such a, it was such a different thing than I'd ever heard before. In, you know, because I was in, you know, I was a, was an amateur musician and spent a lot of time in recording studios when I was a kid. And I just never heard anything like that before. I'd never heard a system that could do that, that could do the surround thing and that could really kind of put you in the bubble and that had that kind of impact because it kind of didn't exist. And it was just such a thrill. And I'm still thrilled by, I'm testing sound bars and I'm sitting there with, you know, Midway, which is a movie I really love. Just putting on the battle scenes and turning the sound bars all the way up and seeing what happens.
Now, which Midway? The newer one or the older one?
Oh. The newer one.
Okay. All right.
I'll date myself further. I saw the original in the theater with Sensorail.
Oh. Wow. What year did that one come out?
It was 70s for 70s. Sure. And like Henry Fonda was in it. But, you know, Sensorround, for those who don't know, was like this thing in the 70s they did with Midway, Earthquake, maybe one or two other movies. And they basically put some subwoofers in the theater, which back then, I don't think theaters even probably had subwoofers. And they put some subwoofers in and threw like a, I don't know, like a 50 hertz sine wave into them at certain, there were certain points in the movie and somehow they would trigger this oscillator that would play the 50 hertz sine wave through the subwoofer. So all of a sudden when it was kind of good for earthquakes, because, you know, earthquakes start.
Yeah.
And end.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was great for them because, like, all of a sudden you're like, and the whole theater is kind of shaking because people never heard notes that low before.
Right.
And it was very exciting. And so, like, when they cut to a scene of the, you know, Dauntless dive bombers on the deck, and I think back then they used actual Dauntless dive bombers, you know, they turned this oscillator on and you'd be, so. No, the new one is a masterpiece, I think. It's just, it's an unbelievably good movie.
I reviewed it over a year ago, the 4K version, and I absolutely loved it. Roland Emmerich, it's like what he did with that was just, it's so much fun. It's like, but the sound on it, the scenes when they're diving down, and it's, I mean, there's so much going on there, and visually and audibly, I thought it was, it is. I thought it was a masterpiece. I love what he did. Did you know he lost? Did you hear that part? And it was in one of the extras. I think his uncle or maybe great uncle actually died of the same thing as, what was the lead character's name? He didn't
Dick
die.
Dick Best was the character. I don't know who the actor was. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So Dick Best, he didn't die of it, but he ended up, remember at the end of the movie, he ends up with
he's crippled from it. Yeah.
Yeah, but his uncle, Roland Emmerich's uncle, died of that. And that's why he wanted to do that movie.
I got to watch the extras then. I usually don't watch the extras, but I really, because that's, I'm unwise to do that. Because once in a while, a lot of times it's kind of like, come on. But sometimes you're really missing out. Actually, I didn't even know that Roland Emmerich did the movie. It's a masterpiece to me because I'm like a World War II movie fanatic and have been since I was a little kid. And the thing I love the most, not only is the sound great, but the battle scenes, you know, it's all CG, but it doesn't feel like CG. You know that, you know the Harrison Ford movie with the dog, the new one, Call of the Wild? Have you seen that one?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It's like,
I haven't seen it in its entirety, but I know what it is.
Oh, I'll tell you what. As soon as the CG dog came on, I'm like, no way. No way. It's too far into the uncanny valley. I cannot suspend my disbelief for this. So with Midway, I have to remind myself that those planes are fake, but they just don't look it. And you really get a feel for what it was like to fly a dive bomber back then and how harrowing that was. And how, you know, I've read about World War II my whole life because, you know, that's what kids did when you grew up in the 70s. You read about World War II and boys and, you know, to understand what those guys went through, and you can really get a feel for, like, they just had to go almost, you know, straight down onto that ship, and they were just facing all this fire, and it was just completely random as to who died and who didn't. It didn't really depend so much on your piloting skills. It was just whose number comes up. And that whole, I just thought the whole thing was great, especially, you know, compared to the original, which is kind of like, you know, those movies were, they did the best they could at the time. And, you know, plus it probably cost more money to actually fly those planes than it did to do the CG. Because I used to know a girl who was pilot, and I flew with her once. And her her uncle was one of those, guys who collects World War II planes. And way back then in the what was that, the 80s, we flew, he had a P-47, and it was like $1,000 worth of gas an hour to put that thing in the air. And that was back in the 80s. So anyway, I'm rambling. I could ramble about war movies like all for days in a row without stopping.
It's funny you picked that one though, saying Midway, because, well, speaking of the money, Emmerich wanted to make that movie in the early 90s, but he couldn't because of the mm-hmm. budget. He knew how expensive the CGI would have been then. So he didn't do it. He estimated it would have been in the 90s, like 150, 200 million to make.
Yeah.
He ended up making it, I think, for like 55 million at the time when he, because the technology, the price, everything had come down. So it, same idea. He had been wanting, isn't it? It's crazy. And that's, I mean, it's like the entire project was, you know, a passion project for him. And it's funny, like it sounds like you love the movie because of, you know, your love of World War II stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had a listener, that was one of the first podcasts I did where a listener and who's kind of become a friend now called Steve, he didn't like the movie. And he didn't like the CGI. He couldn't get past, like, when they're on the deck. He didn't like it. He knew it was fake, and it bothered him. But it was great for me being a podcaster and being new and having somebody actually go against me, and you get nervous, like, oh, no, I'm making people mad, or I'm wrong. But I'm not. And now here I have you saying you love it, too. I'm like, all right, I can't have a higher praise than you agree with me.
I can see people's point. Because the deck scenes or some of them, but the nice thing is that the way they did the contrast and you know, with HDR and stuff, it looks rather than, I mean, yeah, you could look at it and say, well, that looks fake, but you can also look at it and say it looks stylized, which to me, it looks stylized. It looks like,
that's what I said.
It looks like somebody's memory of December 7 or whatever. And it really, because yeah, it's actually the morning scenes before Pearl Harbor are, those are probably the most stylized. Some of the landscape ocean shots are really kind of stylized looking, but I'm kind of like, that's the look of photography nowadays. I mean, I work with photographers on Wirecutter, and you know, we have a photography staff.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. And I have to shoot photos for Wirecutter too. And I got to like crank up the contrast and crank up the saturation because that's what the kids like these days.
you're looking for something more dynamic. And I said the same thing about Midway in response. I was like, well, I feel like he did that on purpose, knowing his limitations with CGI. And he decided, like, let's make it all match by making the entire thing look uniform. And they, like you said, they cranked everything up and it created a more dynamic color palette, and it really translates well to HDR, I think.
I think so too. And if you look at what they do in like the most recent Marvel productions, even the scenes that aren't CG, the contrast and saturation are cranked up because that's the look now. And you know, that's fine. This doesn't bother me. I mean, if you go back, that's one of the neat things about high quality home video as opposed to VHS, which people probably don't even remember that now, but that's what I lived with. You know, when you have high quality home video, you can go back to all those different eras and you can really kind of savor the different looks that they had back then. You know, those 70s Scorsese movies had a real, you know, Altman movies and stuff like that had this real kind of verite, I guess, look, this real kind of, you know, almost like you're just seeing it live on the street, not hyped up at all. But then, you know, in the 80s, when you started to get into this blockbuster thing and the action movies started to take off, it really, especially once T2 hit, I mean, T2 was the first, I think, really big budget, action movie, and that was over 100 million. Was that early 90s? It was over 100 million, which I think it was the most expensive movie ever made. And the CG back then cost a fortune, and it's really kind of, you know, nothing compared to what they have now. But you know, that changed the look, and then things became a lot more, you know, as CG rolled in, things became a lot more kind of fake looking, for want of a better term. And then I guess probably about 10 years ago or something, 10 or 15 years ago, this high contrast thing started to roll in. And that's, and you know, it spans photography and cinematography. So it's just the look of an era, but it's when I watch movies of a certain era, I want to get that era. I don't want the remastered version of the movie that looks like this era, right? I want that.
Right.
Right. So just like if I listen to an old Rudy Van Gelder jazz recording, I want what it sounded like back then. I really don't want to hear somebody remixing it or remastering it. So
it's funny you say that, because one of the things I wanted to ask you today is, have you had a chance to listen to music with Dolby Atmos? Like Apple just dropped their stuff a couple of weeks ago, and how it moves through the room. I've done the demonstrations in my theater, listening to it. And it just, to me, I'm not one to sit down and listen to music in a room. Just, I need to be moving. If you watch me on podcast, just sitting here, I'm wiggling. I need to move. I need to do something. I need to watch something. Sure. Right. So to sit and take away one of my senses, which is eyes, and just listen is weird for me. But this new Dolby Atmos thing, it's awesome. I like it.
Well, I was really lucky because I wrote about this for Jazz Times. I follow the pro audio world a lot too, since I'm a musician. I do some recording and stuff. And I've written a little bit about that. And I've consulted for a couple of those companies. But So I saw that Atmos was getting a lot of buzz in the Pro Mags about a year and a half ago, and right before the pandemic hit. And so I pitched Jazz Times, which I'm the audio columnist for Jazz Times. I pitched them on doing an article about Atmos because I thought, and then I saw Blue Note was starting to get into it. I'm like, all right, we got to cover this. Because normally in jazz, it's not exactly high tech, right? It's pretty straightforward. They do the albums in a day. And so, to my surprise, Dolby actually flew some people down to LA. They have a, because you know, it's not like Jazz Times is this hugely influential magazine in the audio world, maybe in jazz, but not in audio.
Right.
But so I was like, wow, you doing all this for me? And so they have this, Dolby has this sort of secret theater, and it's not labeled on the outside. It looks like an old theater that's been shut down, that's on Sunset, I guess. And in Hollywood. And so they invite, but when you go inside, it's absolutely state of the art. And, you know, it's updated with whatever the latest Dolby technologies are, and also whatever technologies they're working on. And it's got umpteen zillion, it's not a real big theater, but it's got umpteen zillion speakers, you know, all whatever the maximum number you could benefit from with Atmos is. And it's tuned to absolute perfection. And so they gave me Christine Thomas, who is their head of, I think she's like their outreach person for the music industry, gave me this demo, and it played me all this stuff. And some of it was even just going among the different Blue Note mixes, not even to mention the rock mixes and pop mixes and hip-hop mixes and all that stuff. Just with the Blue Note mixes, it was such a wide variation, because you'd have like the, what was it, Norah Jones, whatever the big hit tune of hers was 15 years ago. It was kind of an amorphous blob in front of you. I'm kind of like, well, no, because no matter how you stack it up, whether you're a live gig or you're listening to stereo, Norah Jones is supposed to come from right there. And she was kind of a blob.
Okay.
And I didn't like that. It's a lot of the whole thing was a big blob. But then they put on this Wayne Shorter thing, a cut called Infant Eyes from, you know, 60s thing. And it was like being in a studio with a band. Like, you really kind of got this sonic image of Wayne Shorter kind of not too far from you here. And the drums and piano were back further in the studio. And it was just, and it sounded real. It sounded like a real jazz band. It didn't sound gimmicky. And
yeah.
And you know, the process, you can do Atmos by, you know, it's a neutral carrier. It's just like stereo. What does stereo sound like? I don't know. You can do mono in stereo. You can do amazing Chesky type things where you capture this incredible ambience in stereo, or you can do fake pan potted stuff with reverb, or you can have all sorts. So Atmos is not a sound, it's what people do with it. And if they take the trouble to do something really good, it's and the engineers and the producer have good taste, it's going to be amazing. If they just sort of, because, you know, sometimes, you know, with surround sound, you know, with just 5.1, 7.1,
yep.
Sometimes people, like if they're remixing music or something, sometimes they just throw stuff in the back channels and call it a day.
Yeah.
But when they put the work into it, and the people are really talented and they have good taste, then you can get something absolutely amazing out of it. So that's the frustrating thing for me, is it... I was going back and forth with Lauren Dragon, who's the headphone editor of Wirecutter, and we're like texting each other, you know, like the day after the announcement, we're listening to all this stuff and we're texting each other. Have you heard this? Have you heard this? This sucks. This is great. Back and forth. And there were so many things where you do it with the headphones and you couldn't hear a difference between the Dolby Atmos and the other thing. And you'd hear like maybe right. that. You'd be like, yeah, it's different, but not that different. And then, but then what, I mean, to me, the big payoff is when you get it on a home theater system on headphones, the best mixes are good. The worst mixes are, but on yeah. home theaters, the best mixes are you, as you heard, the best mixes are just mind blowing. They're just absolutely yeah. great. So,
yeah,
it has a lot of, it has a lot of potential. And of course, you know, it's hard to make money selling things that you do in a studio now. So when, you know, when you're looking at spending $5,000 or $10,000 on doing Atmos remixes, I'm just guessing as to what it costs, but that's probably it's probably lowball for big names.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably, I'm guessing that's what, like Blue Note probably spent $5,000 or $10,000 per album that they redid. And, I'm probably being an idiot, probably $10,000 to $20,000. You know, you look at, well, what's the payback on that? And it's like, are you going to make their money back on that? Probably not. So they probably just did it for the PR benefits and figuring, hey, yes. you know what? There's going to be a lot of demos of this and we can get some Blue Note stuff on there and get people exposed to Blue Note. So, but you know, there's no way to make money selling recordings unless you're Taylor Swift. So, whether people are willing to spend $10,000 or $20,000 or more to do Atmos mixes, time will tell.
Yeah. You know,
but they're building it into all though. They built it into Apple Logic, which is the one of the DAWs right. that a lot of people use, especially sort of lower end production. You know, musicians who do stuff on their own and stuff. A lot of them use Logic, so. You'll be able to kind of just throw stuff into, you know, into and steer your vectors and stuff and do something. And I kind of feel like fooling with it myself because I do some, I'm a jazz artist. I'm yeah. actually sort of, I'm even signed to a label.
Nice.
Well, it's like, what does that mean nowadays? I mean, our labels. Basically, she kicks us in the butt to get stuff done more than anything else. But so I kind of want to fool with it and try these things, especially since we could just release it on Apple Music. I don't have to burn this to some wacky kind of disc, right?
Right.
So you can just dump it on Apple Music and people have Atmos. So I could do our stuff in Atmos and some of it would probably sound really good in Atmos. And, you know... if I get a break from reviewing soundbars anytime soon, I might do that. But Wirecutter doesn't give me a lot of breaks from the pile of soundbars is going to be a pile of Bluetooth speakers in another week. So
yeah. Well, you're being pulled all over the place.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So what were your favorite Atmos music mixes? Because you're listening through a home theater, right?
Yeah.
Great.
Well, okay. It's fun. Like, I really enjoy, like, as somebody, like, I enjoyed the demonstration that they used with Marvin Gaye, and they used one of his songs, and they did the whole mono to stereo to Atmos, and you they demonstrated all of them for you. And it's funny you said, like, you can do mono through stereo, you can do this. And it's like, if I'm looking at my receiver, it actually said, you know, Atmos, but they were playing mono through it. And then they gave you a little description on where you would be hearing the sound, and you could hear it open up just slightly for a stereo sound, because you heard a little bit more separation, but the jump wasn't that big from mono to stereo. It was just sitting there in the prime seat in my theater. But when they went to Atmos, it literally came off of the front wall and enveloped you all the way around the room. You could, and that was, it was just a 2-minute demo, right? But then going through listening to Riders on the Storm from the Doors, and they had the thunder going over the top, which is gimmicky. I know that's not part of the music.
I don't think I listened to that one. I'm making notes right now. Go ahead.
So, but that one I really liked. But then just flipping through some of the rock and like Lunatic Fringe, the way it filled the room. There were some other songs my wife and I listened to where you were in the middle of the room, and the people, like, you'd hear people snapping their fingers like this, but it was behind you, and it was appropriately placed. Like you mentioned earlier with being in a jazz band, it was like you were on the stage, and everybody was placed around you, and you're sitting there listening to it. Another one, probably not, maybe not your genre, but Poison, and it was Every Rose Has Its Thorn. And that one starts out acoustically, and it starts out dead center in front of you, but the whole band comes in and joins the song. It probably about a minute in, and when they join the song, they come in all around you. But how clear the acoustic sound, you could, it's like you could hear the plucking of each string practically. And then when the band comes in, it was just something that I hadn't experienced before.
Oh, I got to listen to that. And just for the record, my sort of main genres are jazz and metal. So Poison is not a problem.
Well, I've always said, since I was a kid, I've always said Poison's like a guilty pleasure, because there's a lot of people that are like, oh, Poison? They're not musicians. I'm like, I love them. I have a blast with it. But yeah, there was that one. I can't remember the one my son pointed out to me. It was a more modern song. Kanye West song.
Oh, and was it Black Skinhead?
Yes.
That's on the Fantastic. Apple demo. That was one of my favorites. That was amazing.
Oh, yeah. My God. And my son knew it right away when I brought him in to listen. And he goes, you got to put on this Kanye song. And I was like, why? He goes, it just, and he had never heard it in Atmos. He just knows from hearing it has like that crazy opening with all of the different sounds and the way they move the music. He goes, it's going to sound crazy. And I was like, all right, we put it on. And I was like, wow. It is. It's a fantastic soundtrack. You're like, this is a blast to listen to.
Yeah. Did you listen to the Tiesto thing? It was way down the list.
I don't think so.
It was, EDM, EDM, Tiesto and some other guy. And so it's, dun, 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 that kind of, EDM thing. I don't mean to disparage EDM. I like EDM. It's okay.
No.
But, a lot of EDM kind of sounds like EDM. Anyway, they really, you should listen to that one. They really flew some stuff around the room. And
oh, cool.
I don't want to say that, hey, the answer with Atmos is just throw some stuff around in the back. But they created a sense of the music swirling around you and enveloping you. And I thought that was artistically very valid. And I mean, it's not realistic, but from an artistic standpoint, I thought it was really, especially coming out of home theater where you do, you have airplanes flying overhead and bullets whizzing around. And so I don't see why music can't do that once in a while. I mean, if it's a jazz group, maybe you don't want to fly the saxophone around behind you, but because that would be, hey, somebody might make it work someday, but for now I'm going to say that's probably going to always sound stupid. But, I don't see why, especially with artificial music forms like EDM and hip hop that are all done in the box, in the computer with you know, little MIDI pads that you go like that on, not no like real instruments at all. Why not? Why not go for a different aesthetic? I mean, the you know, kids, you know, your son is not bound by the aesthetics that you and I are coming up in the 90s with home theater stuff or and the music we listened to back then. It was all recorded on tape. And, you know, so I think it's really healthy when people push the limits and try to do some stuff. I mean, like the Stephen Wilson stuff that, you know, his remixes of Prague are, I think, by and large, really good. You know, it's not gimmicky, and it helps you hear all the different instruments in some of those mixes, which you couldn't hear back when they were, you know, mixing them down to, you know, they're all analog tape, mixed down to analog through a couple generations with God knows what they had to do to get the effects they did back then. It was really, you know, complicated. And so the instruments in old Yes recordings and stuff are a little bit of a blur. And he breaks it all out in surround so you can hear the instruments better. You get a better sense of space. And he doesn't change, in my view, he doesn't alter the original aesthetic of it. So I love all this stuff. I mean, to me, it's just really great. My big issue is I review so much gear now that it's hard for me to keep a surround sound system going because I got a million sound bars to review, and it's going to be like another week and a half of that at least, except more are coming in because clips.
It's funny. That's one of the,
somebody just introduced a bunch of new sound bars that look interesting.
Oh, but it's funny you say that because one of the things I was like, I've got to ask him this. I'm like, you listen to so much equipment over the years, and right now it's sound bars, but you've done subwoofers. You've done everything, right? You kind of answered it, but does that taint your experience for movies when you go to sit down and watch a movie just for yourself?
It makes me more... I'm so used to hearing movies presented in different ways, especially with like these sound bars. They all have, some of them are amazing, and some of them it's just like you're almost like you're just listening to a little Bluetooth speaker. They're so bad. But so I've become forgiving of, but you know, I make myself like when I watch movies at night, like 10 o'clock, I'll put on something, right? Usually. And you know, sit down with my dog and kind of relax a little bit and just watch something on whatever I'm testing and or whatever I feel curious about. And I've gotten used to hearing so many different presentations of sound that I am probably a lot more forgiving than most people. However, if I blow my own horn a little bit, I've been measuring speakers for 25 years. I've been reviewing them for 30, and you know, I know all the scientists and engineers who are really expert on this. I know. I talk to them on the phone all the time. And you know, and I write, and now I write for VoiceCoil, which is a speaker technology magazine, and Audio Express, which is another like super technical journal. So it's like, I know, I understand very, very well the engineering flaws that certain speakers have. And so when I hear those, it just drives me nuts. And I have a problem like Kaptan's coloration, right? Where stuff sounds like this is really common. Yeah. And it's an engineering error that it should basically, there's kind of almost no excuse for that happening because it's an engineering error. And, you know, it's basically doing your crossover points wrong. And, you know, for the drivers that you've selected. And it's in my view, it's always correctable. And when I hear that, I'm just like, I'm not going to listen to it. I'm not going to waste 2 hours of my time and maybe a movie that I might only watch once on some junky speaker. But I'm churning gear all the time. So I have some Revels that I use for stereo, and then I have some an ELAC system I've been using a lot for surround, because it's not the fanciest thing in the world, but it works really well. And it's our current like upgrade pick on Wirecutter, so I have to shoot everything out against that. So,
oh, okay.
It's very different being, it's like if you're an enthusiast, you can sort of, you can invest in, you know, if I was an enthusiast, right, I'd go fill out the rest of my Revel system with surrounds, and I would get it dialed in with at least two subwoofers, and I would get it, and I'd have an EQ on the subs, and I'd get it absolutely perfect for my little seating position there. It would be fantastic, but I just don't. Reviewers, if they're busy, you know, if they do one review every two, 3 months, that's different. But if you're making a living at it like I do, then you don't really have that luxury. That's where headphones come in, because I can always put on my Biodynamic T5s and other ones, and have a absolutely, you know, world class experience whenever I want it without having to set something up for an hour.
So
one of the reasons I love headphones. Also, they don't take up much space. They're easy to measure, and they're easy to pack up and send back to the manufacturer. if you're making a living at something, it's very different from being an enthusiast at it, you know?
Right.
And like my bicycles, I are pretty fine-tuned, because I don't have to change out parts on them. You know, they're all dialed in for me, and I don't even want to ride anything else, because my stuff is, you know, the bass that I play is dialed in for me. I wouldn't want to review basses, because then I'd have to play other basses, and my bass is kind of right where I want it.
Right.
So,
said that about bicycles too. Because I saw that you wrote for Bicycling Magazine, and I've
a couple articles in it.
Yeah, but I saw it in the bio. I was like, he wrote for Bicycling? How'd I miss that? Because I would have been like, if I had seen that back when I was reading Bicycling Magazine all the time, it would have blown my mind. I was like, what the hell? What's he doing here?
Oh, well, I'll tell you, it's you know, I was living in New York, and I was a cycling fanatic, and I would go out every weekend and do like a century or something right up to Bear Mountain or something from the city. I was going out and doing 40 and 50 milers before work. I was video magazine, like, didn't care if I showed up at 10. So I'd go out and bang out really long rides, like, you know, before work and stuff. And I'd do, you know, like 2-3 laps around Central Park or whatever. So I was, and I was using it to explore New York. It was just an amazing time. And so I saw an ad that Bicycling Magazine had was looking for a associate editor or something like that. And so I went out to Emmaus, Pennsylvania, and on the bus really early in the morning, and interviewed with them, and spent the better part of a day there. And it was down to me and one other guy, and the other guy got it. And his name is Bill Strickland, and he's the best bicycling writer who's ever written on the subject, in my opinion. And he rose to become editor of the magazine, and he's published some books, and they hired the right guy. So, but however, in the process of the interview, you know, they got to know me, and I did write a couple articles for him. So, but I didn't really pursue it, because I was too busy at that time. My work at Video was really ramping up, and I was building the name there. So I just got too drawn into that to pursue writing about bikes anymore.
That's so, it's just funny that I saw it. Oh yeah, I used to
mountain bike,
I still
or road?
Ride every both.
Oh, okay.
I grew up on bikes, and then in the mid 90s I really got into mountain biking, and then my buddy's dad was throwing out a bicycle, so I grabbed it, painted the frame, revamped all the components, and rode that for probably 3 or 4 years till I got a more modern bike, which was probably in like 99 or something like that. But same as you, I would go out and just ride, just go get lost and come home. And I remember the first time I did a century, I trained to do it the wrong way. I trained by going out like for 1 hour and just hammer as hard as I could go for 1 hour, right? Keeping my heart rate up and everything and all of that. And then one morning I had planned it. It was a Saturday morning. I left the house at 5 a.m. and I just rode 50 miles north. And I knew once I hit 50 that when I turn around and come home, I would be like, that's 100, right? Well, my route up north sent me through Boston, which was a blast because I hit Boston at about 6 a.m., 6:30 in the morning. So no traffic, but I'm going down all these main roads and stuff and having a blast. But I got lost once I was north of Boston and my knee started bothering me. And I learned a ton on this ride. And what I did is all I packed was my wallet and a water bottle, and that was it. So my intention was you'd go 2 hours, get off the bike at a store, grab a Gatorade, a Snickers bar, fill up your water and go for another two. And I kept doing that. Mm-hmm. And I got lost. So I went over 2 hours at like 3 hours without a break, started to feel that bunk when you're like literally like out of energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So feeling dizzy, but I finally found a store, found my bearings. I got that Gatorade and the Snickers bar. And I love this part, like telling people this that are new to cycling and they get that. I'm like, it is the most amazing feeling that when that Gatorade, that Snickers bar and a glass, you know, a cup of water hits your system, it's like if you could feel the gas gauge on your car go up. It's just all of a sudden you're like, yay, you have energy. And I got home. I ended up ruining my knee, but just because I wasn't, you're not supposed to train that way. You need to work up to distance.
Yeah.
And I didn't do that. My heart could do it. My legs weren't used to going around that many revolutions I did it in like 6.5 hours. I was home by like noonish. So I was
pretty good,
but it absolutely had a blast, and I did it a bunch of other times, but yeah, I used to cycle a ton. I ended up doing triathlons and stuff.
Oh, cool.
Love it.
Cool.
Yeah.
I haven't been riding that much since I took up jazz double bass in earnest about 5 or 6 years ago. I haven't been riding that much, and now I have a dog and she kind of keeps me home a lot, but, I'm going to, you know, I know there's going to be another time in my life because I used to tour like crazy, and I want to get back into that because that's one of the most fun things. Doing the Pacific Coast is just best thing I ever, you know, not best, but the most exciting, fun. You know, I did it in pieces. I didn't do the whole thing. But I did like Astoria. Well, I did Portland, rode up to Astoria, Oregon, and then went down to San Francisco. And I think it was like a 3-week trip. And I paused a couple times to write articles for people because I was freelancing. and it was just mind blowing. And you meet so many people. There's so many people from other countries there because they come out to do it. A lot of Europeans do it. It was an amazing experience, and I kind of want to do more. And you know, so but
yeah,
you know,
I did Moab.
Oh,
for mountain biking.
Yeah,
I did a. Me and my buddy went out to Moab and did that for like a long weekend, 4-day trip.
Oh, that must have been awesome.
It was beautiful. It's everything like the magazine, you know, Mountain Biking magazine would have. Any mountain biker, you got to go to Moab, got to go to Moab. And again, this was in the 90s. And I was like, okay. So my wife actually gave it to me for my birthday 1 year. And I went out there in November. And it was incredible. We had so much fun, and you're out there riding on a mountain bike. Yeah. And there's all the four wheeling Jeeps and stuff. And they're amazed by you when you're on the mountain bike, because you're up in the middle of nowhere, like 3 hours in from civilization. And here comes a Jeep, and they're on a tour, and all these people looking out the Jeep, like, look at those guys. Look at those. It's so funny. Like we're like zoo animals. It was pretty funny.
I have to confess, I'm too scared to ride a mountain bike. I bought one, still have it, and I did some riding. Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles, so we're surrounded by mountains, and I rode some stuff, and I was kind of like, yeah, I'm too scared to do this. And plus, I'm old, and you know, falling for me is not really. I figured, you know what? Right. If I do this, I'm gonna fall, and. Nah, I don't want to. And plus, I'm kind of more into the zen of getting on a road and just hitting it for X amount of hours. And I love to do that. I really do. It's a part of my life I miss. And, you know, it was fun because you can actually sort of combine it with audio and video, because I would always have a laptop and like watch movies, you know, with headphones or whatever, and watch movies at night. Because, you know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere at some little, you know, you don't, when you're bike touring, you don't exactly stay at luxury hotels usually. You stay at whatever dump you can find, and you're in those places, and you know, I found that it was a lot more fun to be able to watch stuff on a laptop than to, you know, with some kind of decent headphones, than it was to see what you could get on the horrible TV that they had at the $25 motel.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, exactly. But speaking of crossing the two over, just last week, my daughter, for Father's Day, gave me the new Bose sunglasses with the speakers in them.
I haven't tried them.
Yeah, for cycling, they're fantastic. So it's like, I've worn an earpiece. If I went out for a long ride, I'll put a single earpiece into my right ear, because that's the side of the road that the car's on, right?
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But whatever you're listening to, whether it be podcasts or music or whatever, that ear would still be clogged because you would have that piece into your ear. So now you're only listening for cars on your left side, which while you can still hear them, it just doesn't feel 100% safe. So I went out this week on my bike, and I'm like, I put the Bose sunglasses on, and yet they have interchangeable lenses and everything. So I got the road lenses, I got the mountain bike lenses, I got the mirrored lens. I mean, she gave me the glasses, I got the lenses. But because the sound is coming from, it's like open ear, so the sound is coming just from in front of your ear, you can turn it up pretty good and still hear the traffic coming from a good distance behind you. I felt 100% safer than with just a single earpiece in. And the clarity, I was listening to a podcast, and I was like, I can hear everybody talk perfectly, and I can hear traffic coming from behind me. It was awesome.
I am going to have to try that, because it kind of didn't get on my radar. And, you know, so I review headphones for Soundstage, soundstagesolo.com. And, you know, we pull a lot more traffic when I do high end models than when I do, more mass market stuff. So I focus more on the high end audiophile stuff, but, those kind of never got on my radar. And I saw those in, like Best Buy just the other day. I was kind of like, I never heard those things. I really should probably check them out. And, you know, so they're pretty bulky and stuff, but I'm kind of, I was meeting with a friend of mine, who distributes, measurement gear, you know, audio measurement gear. And he is working as a consultant for not one of the tech giants, but one of the large tech companies. And they're doing like a VR or like an AR, you know, augmented reality glasses. And he's doing the speakers in them. And he's a well-known speaker and headphone designer. And he's doing the speakers in these things. And I was kind of like, you should probably hear those. And I put them on. And they have, so you can still see everything around you, but then you also get images there with whatever you want. And I was kind of like, that's really cool. He said, well, you know, once we get into a little more stable stage of development, I'm going to send you a set. and you can check them out. And I was kind of like, I might enjoy that. You know, I might, it might be something that, because that's a joy to me, is there's so much stuff coming through this house at all times, so much review gear, that between Wirecutter Soundstage and some other things here and there, for me to find something I really love is a great joy. And, you know, something that I love and that I will continue to use is, it's why I love these headphones, because they're closed back and they sound really good, and they're kind of close to Harman Kardon. Yep. So they're neutral sounding. You can plug them into kind of any, I just plugged them straight into my computer here. You can drive them, yep, with anything, and they sound great. And I use them all the time because I have lots of other headphones, but these always work. You know, these are not idiosyncratic. They're not going to tell me I can use them. I can mix on them. I can monitor my jazz recordings. I can use them for pleasure listening. I can use them for movies. I can do anything I want with them. And it's just such a joy, yeah, to find a piece of technology that you really like and really want, as opposed to something that comes in your house and it's like, oh, this is pretty good, this is fine, but then you know, you're like, you don't really miss it when it's gone. But you know, I might really like those glasses. I'm gonna have to try that. Do they have prescription ones?
I don't know. That's a good question. She just bought them at your Best Buy. Just go in, mm-hmm, Best Buy, buy them in a box. I don't know if they are interchangeable lenses, so maybe you could, yeah, do it. I don't know. I have no idea.
Or even if it's just like, I mean, I can see without my glasses, but you know, yeah, I kind of need like a reading prescription. But just like a reading prescription would be enough. I got to check, right, that out. I really have. You know, I've had some, if you write about headphones, then you have a lot of PR people from China pitching you, because there's a million brands and there's a lot of Chinese, because you know everyone knows that most headphones are now made in China, and yeah, but the companies, you know, by companies that are not the brand that's on the headphones. I think these are actually made in Germany, because these are like $1,000, but still. So most headphones are made in China, almost all of them. And those same companies that make the headphones also often have their own brands, and they're looking for attention. And they mostly sell exclusively through Amazon. So they're always looking for attention. I mean, you're just like constantly, if you review headphones, you're going to get a million PR pitches, yeah, from them. And a lot of it's just like, yeah, here's another set of true wireless earphones that are 50 yeah, bucks or 100 bucks. And you're kind of, yeah, like, eh, whatever. But somebody pitched me some of those glasses a few months ago, I think, and I kind of looked at it and kind of thought, I don't know. Is Soundstage going to think I'm too weird if I review those? But I probably should just try a set just to see what they're like. I don't want to freak out my editors by reviewing stuff that,
yeah,
audiophiles it's are going to look definitely at and go, oh, that's stupid, I'm not reading that.
Well, I could definitely see somebody saying that, because they are sunglasses. So it's a very small market where you would be able to wear these and listen to something. And that's why they were perfect for cycling. But I mean, doing the lawn, they probably wouldn't work, because you'd hear the lawn mower.
Yeah.
Even with the, you know, they're, yeah, not noise canceling. So doing outdoor stuff, if you go for a walk, maybe running, jogging, working out outside, definitely, mm-hmm, for that. But I'd be interested to hear what your take on like the actual sound quality is. Cause when you're on a bike and there's wind going by, I'm more concerned with bike safety with what I'm hearing there, sure, than I am with the sound quality. So that's why I saw them a year ago. I didn't buy them, cause I was like, I didn't think gimmicky, like you were saying, but I was, mm-hmm, thinking more like, well, they're like $250. So I was like, do I need, I'm all right. But I mean, the fact my daughter gave them to me for Father's Day, I was like blown away that she even did that. She's only 21 years old, but she's like, she saved pretty up good, and she bought me that. And I was like, holy crap. And then listening to them, I'm like, they are for cycling. I love them. They're fantastic.
Well, and to me, it's running measurements on those would be an interesting challenge. And I'm always, well, yeah. when you're doing measurements, it's like, yeah, you measure headphones. You know, I got a little ear cheek simulator. It's like a fake rubber ear on a thing with a microphone inside and some resonating chambers, right? It's like, they're right. like $10,000 now. I think mine was $5,000 when I bought it. But just the rubber ear, just the fake rubber ear is $800. So anyway, so you clamp the headphone.
That's why I don't have one.
Yeah, well, very few reviewers do. I think I finally make my money back on it. I just so, but you know, I got to have industry standard stuff. I can't have this like $200 thing you measure headphones with. So you put the headphone on there, and you know, it's like kind of always more or less the same. It's like, okay, headphone, run the whoop, you know, frequency response curve and some other stuff. And it's kind of, and I love doing it. It's kick. But it's kind of always the same. But like to get something in like that was like, wait, how do you fit it on the ear to make it? And then how does the different positionings of it on the ear, how's that going to change the sound? And is it going to be consistent? And is it going to look like a headphone response? Or is it going to look like some wacky thing I can't make sense of? And maybe it is some wacky thing I can't make sense of, but it still sounds good. And then I have to figure out why, how. That to me, I mean, I'm 59 years old. I've been doing this for almost 32 years now.
Yeah.
And things like that are what keep me really interested, because there just aren't that many people exploring these things. And, you know, it's like there's still plenty of room in audio to do groundbreaking, you know, research and projects that no one's ever done and trying things no one's ever tried. And that's just a wonderful thing. But it makes me intolerant of people that crank out, you know, the same old stuff.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah. Let's see. One thing I definitely wanted to ask you today. If you could point, is there a single movie you could point to that got you into home theater?
Ooh, I have to think about that. It would have obviously been like early 90s. I would say T2 would be a strong contender, but I think it was before that. You know, T1, I think the original T1 was in mono. Redone it.
Yeah.
You know, they've redone it in 5.1, obviously. But everything on the WOW disc, because when the WOW disc came out, that was right kind of when THX first started. And that's when home theater systems were really just starting to even exist. And
for the masses,
I got one for you. Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now was one of the first really mind-blowing experiences. When they have that the scene where they're in a jungle and they're looking for mangoes, and then this tiger jumps out at them. When you, even through the old ProLogic systems, which had mono surround, you could listen to that and you could hear all the bugs buzzing around you and the birds flying overhead and things like that. And it was like you were in the jungle. And that might have been the first one that I really, really got wrapped up in. That would have been certainly one of the first ones. Yeah, I love that. I should think about that, because I'd love to revisit some of those movies now, because they all have Dolby. I mean, I heard them in Dolby Pro Logic, you know.
Yeah.
Basically, stereo matrixed out to four channels.
Well, Brent, that's what I'm here for. That's my podcast right there. So the future of you and I is, you want to do a movie? We'll break a movie down.
I'd like that.
That's what I do. I break movies down. I do like a movie a week, and or I try to do a movie a week and interviews like this, obviously. But yeah, it's like that would be a blast if you come back. We'll pick a movie. We could do Apocalypse Now someday, and we'll break it down from beginning to end and just go through and talk about the different scenes.
You know, Dick Tracy was a good one. There's a scene in there where Madonna's singing and Mandy Patinkin's playing piano, and the piano's like behind you, and that's the scene that broke a lot of the early THX systems, because they had a decorrelator in there, like a pitch shifting decorrelator to make basically a chorus box that made it sound like the surrounds were in stereo. And so when you put a grand piano or whatever piano through it, you can hear tuning variations on a piano very, very easily, because it's just this perfect constant tone, unlike a saxophone or a guitar. And boy, you put this piano back there with the pitch shifting decorrelator, and all of a sudden it sounded like a beat up old upright. And I was like, yeah, maybe there's only a few scenes where this works, but this is what you're putting your sound through. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad idea, but you know, it had its flaws, and but you know, they were doing their best with what they had. They wanted to create a greater sense of envelopment than ProLogic could do. So I think to some extent it made sense, and it certainly worked with, you know, all the stuff on the WOW disc. And the WOW disc, for those who don't remember it, had Star Wars. It was George Lucas, right? Because it was THX.
Yeah.
He was still involved back then. There was Star Wars. There was the Indiana Jones stuff. There was, I think, Willow was in there. Wasn't that a movie he did? A movie he did that people forgot. No, Howard the Duck, a movie he did that people tried to forget.
Exactly.
And then something else I can't remember, but it was like this nonstop. For those who haven't seen it, sadly, they should re-release it. They probably couldn't now. You know, Disney owns all that stuff anyway. But
yeah,
it was a laser disc, and it had about how long was that thing? About 6, 7, 8 minutes,
and it had a demo scene.
It was a lot of cuts, just a lot of cuts that would start out, and it started off, of course, with you know, whatever they call, I can't remember what they call that sound, the THX sound, and they'd just have all these movie scenes, and it'd be like a few seconds of this, a few seconds of that, and it was specifically chosen by Tom Holman, who's the guy who founded THX. It was specifically chosen by him to show off kind of everything in sound, like dynamics, dialogue clarity, surround envelopment, deep bass, everything. And so with that one disc, I'm not going to say it was the best test disc in the world, but it was sure a lot of fun to watch. That disc, I think, did more to sell the idea of home theater than anything ever created. Because once you saw that,
then any one
that
thing,
system.
You really wanted something to duplicate that, and it was because you wanted to go home and try to duplicate what you got out of that, and to the best of your ability,
it was
fantastic. The guy that I had that I used to buy my laser discs off, it's like we'd sit like this. I'd go into his place on a Friday after work and we'd sit for like 2 hours and just talk about movies and different scenes and pull out the discs and stuff. And the same idea. He'd be like, oh, you got to check this scene out here. And that's what was just, it was so much fun. And that was in the early 90s. And I got my first laser disc player. You know what my first Laserdisc was the Unforgiven. I wanted it to be T2, but the store I was at didn't have T2. I was buying my first Laserdisc player. They didn't have T2, so I bought Unforgiven, and I owned that for a week until I could find a place to buy T2.
So exciting. It was so much fun. I hate to sound like an old guy, but it was so much fun back then because you had a Laserdisc player and probably nobody else did. And it was so much better. It was just infinitely better than VHS, which was, you know, never good. And
Other than flipping the disc.
Yeah, other than flipping the disc. But, and you would, and you probably had, if you had LaserDisc, you probably had a surround sound system. And you had this experience that honestly, at its best, was, you know, you could easily suspend disbelief. And it was, you know, not as good as today's systems, but kind of got you a lot of the same, you know, the same excitement. And then you go out and buy, and of course, LaserDiscs were expensive and, you know, 25 bucks typically. And
they were 40 to 50.
Some of them 40. Yeah. I was too cheap to buy those. But I think I bought like one fancy LaserDisc once in my life. But you know, I could borrow. I never reviewed them or rarely reviewed them, but I could always borrow them from people who did review them, and or rent them. Sometimes a few places rented them. Yep. But it was so exciting and so special to have a LaserDisc. And nowadays, of course, we can get any movie we want in 4K HDR right now. And I guess obviously that's great, but it's less special. And now it's like I stream stuff and I'm kind of like, eh, you know, I don't finish it. Whereas I'm pretty sure every LaserDisc I ever put on, I finished watching at least, you know, the first time.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
So it's like, if you go to the movies, if you go to the movies, you probably don't walk out. You probably watch the whole movie. Whereas now with streaming, I just watched the first episode of Loki last night. I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't get it. Done.
I love Loki. I love the whole MCU.
Everybody loves it. That's the problem. Yeah. I think I've missed too many movies, and everything in there refers back to one of the 20 other things they've done, or more than 20, probably at this point, because now they have TV shows or serials or whatever, and. It's just too hard for me to figure out what's going on. And I'll tell you what, I hate to say this, but one of the things I really miss because of the pandemic is on Fridays, I would either, if I didn't have anything to do, I would either go to Lemley's NoHo 7 in North Hollywood and go have dinner in North Hollywood. There's a lot of good places there. And go watch whatever art movie was there. You know, I say art movie. You know, Lemley's NoHo 7 doesn't have, you know, this week's crappy blockbuster. They have, you know, pretty good movies. There's always something to watch. And then, or I go to the Blue Whale, which is was LA's most awesome, I would argue, the world's most awesome jazz club, but it closed down and it's never coming back. So, but I missed that movie experience. Every time I went to a movie, I mean, the only movie I can remember walking out of was Lost in Space. So, because I was dating a girl at the time. I think it was our second date. I already knew her, but and that first intro came on. That's a pretty good opening scene, I have to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, the first intro comes on where there's like a ring shaped thing out in space, and there's kind of like some dudes and they're shooting it up, and like the dude from Friends is in it. And after that first scene, my date said, "Do you want to leave?" Kind of like, okay. Because it was just like, this is stupid. I don't think I ever watched the whole thing. Maybe it got better. I don't know. Did it get better? I thought it was kind of stupid.
It was okay. But I wasn't a huge Lost in Space fan growing up. I didn't like the show as much. I watched it, but it just didn't do anything for me growing up. The only movie I've ever returned, like, you know, like I buy a LaserDisc, and this was back when I was getting LaserDiscs, was Stallone's Judge Dredd.
Ooh, really?
I didn't like it. I was so excited for that movie. I hadn't seen it in the theater. It came out on LaserDisc, and I was like, I could not wait to get it. I knew it was going to be a great home theater experience. I was like, I get home, I played it, and it just was like, bleh.
That was Rob Schneider, right? Rob Schneider was in it.
Was he in that one, or was that Demolition Man?
Yeah, because he says...
Sometimes I get those
mixed
up.
He does a Stallone impression in it, when he says, I am the law.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
I was going to push back on you and say, I like that movie, but now I remember I didn't. I like the newer Dread, whatever the newer one is.
The newer Dread is right? Awesome.
Yeah, yes. That's a good movie.
I love
but
that
the
movie.
One with Stallone is just like, I mean, it's Stallone. It's, I don't want to criticize Stallone because I've been to a couple cigar gatherings in L.A. where he was there, and I have to be cordial with everybody. So I don't want to. I've actually written about cigars a lot too, and don't really smoke to a significant degree now, but I did. And I used to write for a company that does like a big cigar dinner in L.A. every year or two, and it's always like at the top of the Peninsula Hotel or whatever, and it's just spectacular. You're out in the middle of Century City. You're smoking $20 sticks. You're having this incredible meal. And it's all like cigar dealers and celebrities. And so it'd be like Stallone and like Joe Montana shows up. And like Peter Falk was there one year. The guy that was in Mad About You, that guy.
Oh,
and,
Paul Reiser?
Him. And a whole bunch of those L.A. cigar dudes show up. And Stallone's been to a couple of them. And, Glenn Hughes, formerly of Deep Purple, one of my heroes. And, so it's like a lot of – I don't want to, like, trash celebrities too much because I might have to, like, talk to them.
Well, my last week's podcast, I did Rambo First Blood Part 2. I loved that.
I never saw it. Oh. I didn't like Stallone when I was, you know, growing up. and just because I never even saw one of his movies, I just thought like, oh, this guy's an idiot. My mom and my brother went to see the first Rocky.
Yeah.
And my dad and I opted out. And mom came back and said, oh, he was so stupid. And my mother's from the South. My mother's from New Orleans. She's very outspoken and stuff. And but you know what? I watched that movie, I don't know, 4 years ago or something. Finally watched that movie. That's a great movie.
Oh, really?
The first Rocky? That's a brilliant movie. It's a fantastic.
I know.
It's a masterpiece. It's so good. And I think, you know, you get turned off. I get turned off. When people become like these huge stars and you know, they're in People magazine and you constantly see TV, you know, stupid articles and TV shows about them and stuff. And you're kind of like, I don't want to deal with that person. But sometimes their original work is really that anybody who hasn't seen that movie, I would say watch it because you think Stallone's like this guy. But that's a he did that movie. That was his movie, and it
he wrote it. Yeah,
great. Great.
The negotiation he had to go through to do that movie too, and like he stood by his guns. Like there were people that wanted to take it. They were gonna buy it off him and make it without him, and he refused. And they offered him decent money, but he was just like, "No, I this is mine. I want to produce. I want to do this." He just needed the funding and. He's a smart guy, and a lot of people take his characters, like, you know, Rocky sounds stupid, but he's supposed to. The character's supposed to sound that way, punchy or whatever, and the same Rambo, same idea. It's like he's playing a character. I mean, yes, he has a particular way of talking, but that if you think that that's who the real person is, I mean, I think you're making a big mistake.
They think the character is the actor. And
right,
you know, and as that happens with musicians too, because musicians have a persona, and a lot of them do.
Yeah,
I've met a lot of musicians as well, you know, famous ones, and a lot of them are not like what you expect. A lot of them are, pretty weird, but a lot of them are very normal, average, everyday people that just happen to do this thing for a living, and they're good at it. And some of them are pretty far out there, and you never really know which ones it's going to be.
Yeah. Well, that's the art world, really. You're an artist. It's there are people out there that I went to school for art, and you meet people.
Oh, really?
Like, and whether they're famous or not. Yeah. And whether you're famous or not, you're just, there are people that, like, I was always the outlier because I was, you know, in art school, I was the guy that was normal. I was like, I was into tech. I was into just like, I wasn't the one trying to be different. I wasn't the one wearing the tie-dye back then, or I wasn't the one doing like dressing in all black like some of the kids did, and or just being like different. And that's how people, they were all my friends, but everybody acted. Yeah. But I was like the quote weirdo in that group because in society, they looked at them as weirdos. But when I went into their society, the art world, I was the weirdo. You know what I mean? Not to put labels and stuff on it, but you know what I mean? Like Rhode Island School of Design. I wanted to go there for college. I went there in high school for like 3 years, mm-hmm. took classes. And it was a great experience meeting a lot of people, but everybody was just like, that's the art world. It's a very creative world and people are very creative. And I guess it would be the same with musicians and everything like that. So.
Yeah. Hey, I hate to cut this off, but I have a doctor's appointment.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But can we come back and do Apocalypse Now someday?
Yeah, absolutely. Great. And I haven't thought about this my five movies really that I'm using to test surround sound systems with, and that gets the job done. But there's just so many that I've discarded over the years that I've forgotten. I'd have to go. I actually have one old issue of Video Magazine. I'll have to go back and look at what I was using back then. I think I have old issue of Home Theater too. I save like one issue of every magazine I've written for. I don't know why. Just to remember.
I have a bunch.
Just to remember magazines. Yeah. You know, I miss magazines a lot. It was a great way to make a living, I'll tell you.
Oh yeah, but this was a fun icebreaker. This was
I didn't realize you're old school that you go back as far as I do.
Yeah, well, I started then. Yeah, I'm 9 years younger. I'm only 51, so I'm young compared to you.
Well, yeah, you started. I was 20. Right. Well, we both kind of started right when home theater started to happen.
Right.
So we started. Even though I'm older and I was already working and stuff, but it's like we started. It's kind of you couldn't start a whole lot earlier than we did. I mean,
not unless you had a ton of money. If like people had screening rooms in Hollywood and stuff, and that's what I would read about. That's what got me. Yeah.
Prologic to me is the origin of real home theater.
And VHS,
And that was and Prologic, but you couldn't really do a decent home theater until Prologic happened. And if I remember correctly, that was 87 or 88. And because I was, like I said, I was there for the second generation of Pioneer receivers. And that was early 1990, I think. And I still remember going to the press event. I was like, "Oh, that's weird." I had no idea what it was. I just showed up to the press event. I'm kind of like, "Oh, there's speakers in the back of the room, and they played the test tone through it." I'm kind of like, "What do you do with that?" Literally, I was like. I don't get it. But then I went back and then I started digging in a little bit. I'm like, oh, I'll have to try that. And here I am.
That's awesome.
30-something
years.
There
you
are.
So. And it's awesome to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on. Hey, is there a place people can follow you on Twitter or anything like that? I couldn't find you on Twitter or anything.
I abandoned Twitter. Long time ago, because people want to fight with me, and I can't fight with 140 characters. I can fight with a little more than that, but not 140.
They've upped it to 240.
But still, it's kind of like it's a magnet for
right
unpleasantness. Yeah. So I am on Facebook. I think I'm Brent Butterworth 7 or something. But you can find me. You can find me at BrentButterworth.com is my website, which has some some stuff I've written and some technical things. I just dump stuff on there when I need to. Wirecutter. I'm on Wirecutter.com. I think I review about, let's say 10 or 12 audio categories for them. Most like sound bars, outdoor speakers, bookshelf speakers, surround sound speakers, stereo receivers, Bluetooth speakers, some other stuff, a bunch of things, beard trimmers. SoundstageSolo.com is a headphone specific site that I write about 95% of. You can go to jazztimes.com where I'm the audio columnist there. Or you can just Google Brent Butterworth and whatever topic in audio you want to read about, and something's going to come up.
Yes.
Maybe it could be like somebody on some, it's probably going to be somebody on some forum trashing me, but whatever. Go read that too.
Yeah,
go read
exactly.
that too. Get the whole perspective of
exactly.
Decide for yourself.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. But yeah, we'll do Apocalypse Now. We'll start with that one, and then we'll do another one after that. And this is your place to come and actually relive and enjoy those movies.
It's an excuse to rewatch them all now, too.
There you go. Oh, I'll give you plenty of excuses.
That'll be a kick. I'm looking forward to it. It's really great to meet you. It's just.
Thank you.
It's like taking me back like decades. It's just to a. A more civilized time, more civilized era. So,
all right. Cool. Thanks, Brent. I really appreciate it. And we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, DJ. Really good to meet you.
Wow. What did you think? How did I do? I'm not a very good interviewer, but I had so much fun. It didn't feel like, at times it felt like a little bit of an interview, but we really, as it got on, we really started to click and have such a good time talking about movies. And I'm so excited to do Apocalypse Now with him. He's definitely going to come back. We're going to do some more movies. After we were done recording the podcast, we talked for a little bit, and he was like, wow, I didn't know you went back, like he said at the end there, I didn't know you went back as far as I went back. That was so much fun. And he's going to set me up with some other contacts that he has about people that just want to talk home theater. So that's it. I'm like, this is so much fun. I would love to talk. If you guys have anybody that you want me to talk about home theater, let me know. This was a big step for me. This is a huge step for me. I've been, like I said, reading Brent since the 90s, and I owe a lot of thanks to the AV Rant guys. Rob being so accepting at the beginning, first meeting them, and then Tom being the first person coming on with me, he was fantastic. And it's stuff like that. And then of course we go to the HT guys, and they were so awesome. And it just gives me a little bit of confidence. But I also talked to Tom over the last year about how to approach people, and he was really good. I'm like you guys, and that's what I'm trying to bring, is like, I'm just a listener, a reader, a home theater enthusiast, and I just want to bring a little bit of that to you guys. They're all experts. They know this stuff inside and out. I know a bit too, but not like they do. But I want to bring that passion out of these people, and I feel like I did that with Brent this week. Let me know if there's anybody else you guys want me to talk to. It's so much fun. And I just want to bring that out and talk about movies that they love, that why they got into this. And Brent, like you said, we're going to do Apocalypse Now, and he's excited to do it. And I can't ask for more than that. I've been on cloud nine since recording that. I texted Rob right away. I was like, I just recorded with Brent Butler. Like, I didn't want to tell anybody in case it fell through, but hey, thanks to the AV Rent guys for giving me the confidence. Thanks to the HT guys. But Tom, thank you so much for, just giving me the confidence and showing me how to do it and be professional about it behind the scenes and stuff. So thank you very much. Thank you to Brent Butterworth. He has been awesome. Went back and forth for like a month. It was fantastic. So thank you, everybody. And thank you to everybody. You can reach me on Twitter. Thank you to my patrons, my 14 patrons. Thank you to everybody on Twitter, including George's Electronics Marketplace and Rodrigo Bilro, and of course, Squadcast.fm. Again, if it wasn't for them, that would have been it was still a headache, but it would have been a lot worse because the internet connections. I think I was in a storm. He had internet. It was the middle of the day, whatever. But we got it done. The audio was great. Thank you very much. Everybody, thanks for everything. Let's get out of here. It's a great week. Next week, obviously, Independence Day. Everybody have a great 4th of July, because next week we're going to be celebrating Independence Day by doing Independence Day, having fun. Everybody, I'm out of here. Go push play.
Hey, Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production, with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.